On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up to the new equation.
A lot of stuff coming up on the programme, a fairly varied show for you today. So we'll get cracking with our look at the front pages of the Sunday newspapers. We will start with the Sunday Times because it starts with perhaps the easiest story to try and explain. Joe Biden hopes to make a state visit this summer, we are told. The US President Joe Biden is expected to visit Ireland this year, possibly as soon as the summer, the Taoiseach and a senior government official have told Fianna Fáil TDs. The dates are likely to be agreed when Micheál Martin visits the White House on St. Patrick's Day, according to Irish sources. It's possible it could happen this year. A government source said yesterday, maybe we'll have more detail on the date when we're in the White House. March 17th is going to be pivotal. The spokesperson added that lots of people on the American side are working to try and make it happen. The paper says that a summer visit would probably take place before mid-July to allow Biden to address the joint houses of the Oireachtas before TDs and senators begin their two-month summer recess. I love the idea that we have to schedule his visit because TDs are going to go on holidays and we need to make sure that he meets their schedule and not the other way around. The last person to jointly address the joint houses of the Oireachtas was Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the US House of Representatives in 2019. We've also actually at Virgin Media News, we'd heard something similar, and we had heard that the most likely time for a visit would be on either side of a G7 summit, which is due to take place in Bavaria this coming June. So that might be the time at which he's visiting. Also on the front page of the Sunday Times, Fianna Fáil has pulled 5 points clear of Fine Gael, while Micheál Martin has drawn level with Mary Lou McDonald, and satisfaction with the government is up for a third month in a row, according to the latest behaviour and attitudes poll for the Sunday Times. Fianna Fáil is up 1 point to 25%, which is its highest level in 2 years. That is, of course, within the margin of error, but as they say, the trend is your friend, and because his personal approval rating is now up 3 points to 51, it does mean that Micheál Martin is as popular as Mary Lou McDonald, even if Sinn Féin is 9 points ahead of Fianna Fáil in those polls. The front page of the Sunday Independent carries a very interesting story this morning. Inquiry into lockdown events at HSE. The HSE is investigating complaints that staff working at contact tracing centres held at least 3 parties, in inverted commas, in breach of COVID-19 protocols. Inquiries were launched after a whistleblower made a protected disclosure alleging that workplace celebrations to mark events such as birthdays took place at contact tracing centres in 2 locations. The HSE has confirmed that a fact-finding review has begun, but it has not disclosed any details about the gatherings. The Sunday Independent has learned that one of the gatherings complained of by the whistleblower is believed to have taken place at a HSE contact tracing centre in Limerick. The first gathering is understood to have taken place in early 2021 during the third and deadliest wave of the pandemic when the country was in lockdown and more than 1,000 people died. 2 other workplace functions are alleged to have taken place within the past year. All of the parties or gatherings complained of took place at a time when COVID restrictions were in place and when the HSE was urging the public on a daily basis to adhere to the rules and to follow social distancing guidelines. Now, it is worth stating in this particular story that one source characterised the alleged events as parties in the workplace, but another informed source described them as small workplace gatherings at which staff may have breached social distancing guidelines, perhaps maybe comparable to the events in Ivy House that have been raising so much concern. That's the front page of the Sunday Independent. The Sunday Business Post has a whopper of a story this morning. Leaked audio reveals financial dysfunction and distrust in the health system. And we're going to talk about this in more detail in just a couple of minutes. But a leaked recording of an internal Department of Health meeting has revealed worrying concerns around fake targets, dysfunction and distrust at the heart of the health system. The Business Post has obtained a recording of a meeting of departmental officials held on January the 27th, that's only a little over 2 weeks ago, to discuss issues which were on the agenda for the Health Budget Oversight Group, which also includes the Department of Public Expenditure and the HSE. The comments made by those in attendance provide an unprecedented level of transparency into the inner workings of the health system by the very people who oversee it. Those present at the meeting were not aware that it was being recorded, so they were speaking freely. These issues are now being raised by the Business Post, it says, in the public interest. It's a very long story, and as I said, we might get into it in more detail in just a couple of minutes. But among the bullet points on the front page of the paper, which are outlined within this conversation, the under-recruitment of 10,000 staff budgeted for in this year, there'll be a shortfall of 4,500 staff, leading to a surplus of around €250 million. The consequences of these, quote, fake targets for recruitment, which are driven by politicians. There's also a reference to recent revelations about the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services in South Kerry. There's concern around the damage being done to the Taoiseach's confidence in the Department of Health and the HSE. That's Aoife Moore, who's already scoffing as if politicians had confidence in the HSE to begin with. A fundamental error in the HSE's 2020 accounts, potentially relating to hundreds of millions of euro, and incredulity that the Comptroller and Auditor General, who is the state's accountancy and auditing watchdog, had actually signed off on the accounts at all. A CNAG investigation into recruitment practices at the HSE, with reference to consultants being hired at rates above the starting salary on their pay scale, officials alleging sloppy and inadequate financial reporting by the HSE, and questions over the HSE board's activities on financial issues. A spokesperson for the Department of Health did not respond to detailed queries about the issues raised at the meeting. Aoife Moore, as I said, political correspondent with the Irish Examiner, and Jack Horgan-Jones, political reporter with the Irish Times, are both with me in studio. Aoife, I know you're sort of scoffing at the idea that anyone would have confidence in the HSE, but when you put all of those things together, and these are being openly and frankly talked about by civil servants when they think there isn't going to be a record, it's pretty unsettling.
I don't think anyone who has ever had any dealings with the HSE would be in any way surprised at the quotes in the Sunday Business Post today. I would urge everyone to read this story. It is amazing. Some of the quotes are, if you wrote it in a sitcom, people wouldn't put it in because it is too on the nose. I mean, the notion that they didn't know the end of year financial position for the HSE in order to tell the minister. You know, at one point, there's a quote that says, "You might be assuming a degree of pride in work and professionalism that isn't always evident." I mean, the thing is, too, everybody complains about the HSE and everyone talks about the HSE and the government acts like they have absolutely no remit. Someone, and this goes for the lockdown parties as well, it betrays a serious lack of decent management within the HSE. Someone needs to go on to this organisation and it needs to be a top-down review about what is happening and sort it out, because it is the vulnerable people who pay the price.
I presume they probably thought that the appointment of Paul Reid, who used to have a history at the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, that they thought appointing him would be the start of a cultural shift and this kind of reining in of generation upon layer of middle management.
I think every opposition politician who has any kind of portfolio in health should be calling for Paul Reid to come in front of their Act as Health Committee and explain what is going on at the HSE, because this is damning. And I know we're all laughing and it doesn't come as much as a surprise, but the evidence is now here in front of us. How bad it is.
The evidence, Jack, is pretty extraordinary that they're openly talking about being given figures for recruitment that they know they're not going to meet. And then one of the concerns that's raised in this story is, how do we get to keep the €250 million, which was set aside for salaries of people that we know we can't hire?
Yeah, and do you know what? It's actually not just the HSE. Do you know, it's the whole kind of apparatus of making healthcare policy. Do you know what I mean? Because you look at, you know, there's stuff in there about Mary Butler, the Minister for Older People and Mental Health.
Yeah.
And
who was pushing for a certain number of recruitment.
For a higher budget for mental health services, which is kind of what you'd expect from the wheelhouse of someone.
From anyone.
But like, they clearly behind closed doors are saying, we have a budget of 10 million here. That's how much we can spend. And the thing gets so heavily politicised that all of a sudden the budget jumps up to 23 million. And I think that the biggest and most kind of concerning thing that emerges from this whole double page spread, and much like Aoife, I think everyone should go out and read this, is that for so long we thought that the problems within Irish healthcare could be located in, you know, a lack of cash. You know, that they were underfunded. But I think this shows that even when the money is kind of being stuffed down the throat of the system, when all those kind of fiscal constraints are falling away, arising probably from COVID more than anything
else. But it creates a culture where basically money is available.
Where the money is available, and it becomes more about a game of kind of retention of budgets and shuffling money around the health service if you can't spend it in the way it's intended to be spent. And I think that's why it's so kind of profoundly concerning. And then, you know, it's just it's the unvarnished nature of how they describe the reporting from the HSC. It's garbage and all the rest of it. And it's just,
it's
shocking. You
there's a quote here, and it says that their reporting has been described as sloppiness, garbage and shite.
Apologies to younger listeners who are listening in at 11:11 this morning, but
that's our health service. That's our health service.
That's the health service you're talking about there. I mean, I think we've always known that there was a culture within the public service that if there's a budget unspent, or if a budget is not going to be spent, that there's some politics around making sure that you do spend the money one way or another. Because if you don't spend it this year, you're not going to get it next year. And of course, you always want to protect your own fiefdom. The point about mental health is an interesting one. There's two paragraphs here about exactly how all of that was going to be done. On mental health, and this is a quote from one official in the finance unit of the Department of Health who was quoted in this conversation. On mental health, the HSE originally wanted an extra 10 million. We gave them 23 million or so for 300 new staff. They said in no way could they recruit those 300 new staff. And it was Minister Butler, that's Mary Butler, as you said, the Minister of State for Mental Health and Older People, who actually wanted to give them originally 36 million or something like that. The HSE have said all along, we won't be able to spend this. And they're still saying that. But this was driven by us and the Minister. They didn't want the money. They wanted 10. We gave them 23. So it's probably not fair on all sides to say that the HSE wanted it. Some of this was effectively problems of our own making, but driven by the politicians.
But the politicians is an interesting one as well, because there's other quotes in there which kind of squarely locate a lot of the blame for this within the politicians. And as we said, you know, that's to be expected from the political system. They're going to lobby for greater budgets and going to point to them when they achieve them. But like the stuff that's in there, it's just, as I say, it's so unvarnished. You know, more importantly, the politicians. The politicians are driving this. If you're promising stuff and not delivering it while getting funding, it's even worse for your reputation. And then there's a line attributed to Stephen Donnelly in there as well, Minister for Health, who is talking to, so this is an official who's come across from DEEPR, the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, who are kind of seen as the more parsimonious arm of government, and has come across to work in the Department of Health. And she's characterising her interactions with the Minister for Health, who she says talks to her and says regularly, "You're DEEPR, Louise, start spending a bit of money. We like to spend money here," you know, and that kind of almost kind of loads of money approaches.
Like the target or the aim of government is to spend money, not rather to kind of secure outcomes.
Yeah, to be successful in this kind of bureaucratic game of chess to like secure the most budget possible as opposed to spending it well, you know. And I think that that's probably, and they reference CAMHS in this piece as well.
Yeah, this is what I want to come back to, is like if we move away from this is hilarious and how they are talking about how they can't spend 23 million, and we take a step back and we look at the health service and we look at the trolley numbers and we look what happened in CAMHS and we look at the people who need mental health services and waiting lists and everything else, this is not good enough. And Paul Reid needs to come before a committee and explain how this happened. Why, when he was hired and he was told what he had to do to reform this, it clearly has not been done. I think if this isn't brought up in the Dáil on Tuesday, there is going to be, I just think it'll be a massive failure of the opposition and government. And I really, really feel like it's so disheartening. You know, we know how bad the health service is, and this is the way they're openly talking about it.
Just for context, by the way, just to put some meat in the bones of what you've just said there, as of 8 o'clock this morning, per the HSE's own figures, there were 237 people on trolleys in emergency departments alone. That ignores those who are on trolleys in other departments, which are included in the INMO's daily trolley watch figure. Of those, 122 have been on trolleys for over 9 hours. 51 of them have been on trolleys for over 24 hours. That means that 51 people were on a trolley at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning and were still on that trolley awaiting full hospital admission at 8 o'clock on a Sunday. And if they were to wake up on a Sunday morning, I say wake up as if you get to sleep in a hospital trolley in an ED overnight, and then to see that there's squabbling over us not being able to spend the money.
It's back to the future. It's an old style healthcare scandal, you know, and we almost kind of forgot about these during COVID we had so many other scandals, but also, you know, the HSE were kind of rightly being lauded
as the frontline workers, the right to the flag,
they're the RAF during the Battle of Britain and all the rest of it. And then COVID recedes and all of a sudden you see the traditional kind of modes of Irish healthcare politics emerging. And I think that people who are at the top of health policy and the health service in Ireland, so the likes of Paul Reid, Stephen Donnelly and Robert Watt, you know, this is going to be healthcare politics red in tooth and claw again. And as Aoife says, it's going to be a thing in the Dáil. They're going to be hauled, I would imagine, in front of the Health Committee at a minimum. But also, I'd say the Public Accounts Committee would have an interest given the discussion of the CNAG's role.
On that note, because there's one of the officials reveals during a call with HSE financial staff that they've been informed, not alone that the Department of Health, as you mentioned, Jack, was not quite sure what the HSE's year-end position was for 2021, but that they're also talking about doing what they call prior year adjustments for 2020, which is described as an interesting development. The Business Post defines this as usually a correction of errors in the reporting on a company's prior period financial statement. In other words, basically that the HSE will be going back and correcting the accounts that it compiled for 2020, which is obviously a fairly concerning development in and of itself. By the way, I should say we did invite Stephen Donnelly, the Minister for Health, onto the programme this morning to address some of the issues that are raised by this article. We were told he wasn't available. A question for either of you. When it comes to, and let's focus in on mental health as the example here, a minister saying, right, I want this much money because I want to be able to recruit this many more staff. Mm-hmm. And of course, a minister, and everyone would say, yes, we'd like more staff, because the reason why you have waiting lists and the reason why these things compound is because there are not enough people operating the services, yeah, and you need to increase capacity, and that means putting more people. When they say they can't recruit 300 more staff, is it a lack of ambition, or is it just ministers being so focused on the bottom line of having more staff that they don't realise you need to train up these staff and then encourage people to enter into programmes to become these staff?
It's heavily political, isn't it?
Yeah,
like, the idea that you're going to stuff more people into the healthcare system, and like, you see that they set this target last year, 14,000 full-time equivalents, missed it, and rather than perhaps pick up, you know, the suggestion that like there may be deeper issues underlying as to why they can't attract these people, they're like, okay, next year 10,000.
Yeah.
And because they're told again, but you can only get 5,500.
Yeah, because what the minister wants to be able to come before the Dáil, and when they are criticised by the opposition, the minister wants to be able to say, well, I have hired X amount of people, look at all the stuff I'm doing. And if staff are coming to the minister and saying, we are not going to be able to hire these people, then there is a bigger problem. And why are politicians not looking for the root of the problem, which might be, you know, lack of work-life balance in health services, per wages compared to other countries, young people getting trained up in Irish universities and heading off to Australia where they're treated better and paid properly. That might be a problem that we need to start looking at, and it appears that it is now, and this is the chickens coming home to roost.
Yeah.
So it does appear to me that they want to, that we know that money's not an issue, right? They're throwing all the money at the problem, but the throwing money at the problem is only good for the optics. It doesn't help anybody in the health service.
It's just kind of like, I mean, one of the problems that we all were familiar with COVID was that we had this public health system that was really badly underinvested in for ages. And that's kind of because public health was never fashionable. Do you know what I mean? No one ever spoke about public health when it came to the annual carve up of the budget. And I think that like what this story shows is that budget follows kind of things that are politically modish like, you know, politically opportune at the time. And that perhaps that's why it flowed not incorrectly towards mental health this time, but obviously incorrectly in terms of the alignment between the budget, the outcomes and what could realistically be achieved. So like it raises deeper questions, I think, about you know, the whole kind of interaction between the budgetary cycle, the annual budgetary cycle, and something like healthcare policy, which is much longer term in terms of how it should set out to achieve targets.
One thing which isn't at all made clear, because it's not defined within this conversation, but one thing I'd really like to hear elaborated on this week is how much politicians know when they're putting in their lobbying for the budget, how much they know that it's not going to be spent, or how much they know that the target they're looking for is pie in the sky, that if someone ever tells them, we're not going to be able to recruit the people that you're budgeting for.
Yeah, and I would say if Mary Butler is going to the Department of Public Expenditure and asking for more money, that is what she is supposed to be doing. That is what a good minister does. She lobbies for more money. But also I would wonder why there's not a bigger question of, or talking to someone else and saying, here, I have problems in my department. They're telling me they can't get the staff. Why is that not a question around at budget time? And it might be then invested in the Department of Higher Education. We need more people trained up as nurses. We need more trained up in health services. But because the Department of Higher Education doesn't seem as a very important department, they're not going to get as much money.
It's their old friend joined up thinking, isn't
well,
it?
Yeah. It's also probably the fact that maybe the minister responsible for higher education has been sort of, for several reasons, trying to keep away from the health area for the last couple of years, and people would maybe quite like him to stay away from the health area. Good morning, by the way, to Dahi, who says that Aoife Moore trying not to laugh at the headlines as Gavin Riley reads them out is my new mood. And so say all of us. The other health story on the front page of the papers today is that one on the Sunday Independent about lockdown events at the HSE. And again, probably worth stressing that there's different accounts of these events. Some people saying that they are outright parties. Some other people saying that they are small workplace gatherings where people who were working with each other were there anyway, but simply just dispensed with social distancing for a brief period of time. But again, Aoife, it's not a good look.
No, and as I said earlier, this also betrays just very poor management within the HSE. I think, you know, when we look at all the stories that we've seen today about the HSE, that's what like screams to me. Just like bad management. And listen, we're all human. Lockdown was tough. I completely get it. I do not think this is in any way on the same level as Boris Johnson and his many, many parties. It was like a Freshers' Week in Downing Street. I don't think we're in anywhere near that. But I do think it betrays just a general there is a general kind of bad management. Yeah.
There's an accumulation as well, mm-hmm, though, isn't there? Like, yeah. It's a kind of, you know, one of them, you kind of see, you see the champagne gate and you kind of say, well, like, I mean, not great, obviously, but not an accumulation like Boris Johnson. But then you see this, you see the Defence Forces, you see this now today in the Sunday Independent, and you do kind of start to think, right, okay, well, clearly, to a greater or lesser extent, when people were allowed to congregate, some people were then socialising, let's call it, afterwards. And, you know, one man's post-workplace gathering is another man's party, I'm sure. But, like,
well, yeah.
It depends how good your parties are, I suppose.
It does depend on how good your parties are. Maybe that's what Stephen Donnelly will find himself in the Dáil this week accounting for. How good are the parties?
What's the threshold for a party? Yeah. You know, like, is it champagne? Is it merely sparkling wine?
Were you accosted with a cake?
Ambushed. One complaint related to people gathering, quote, in an office for a birthday during working hours or immediately after work, the informed source said. This is not to minimise the situation. If there were breaches of social distancing rules, then that is wrong, and people working in a contact tracing centre of all places should know better. These alleged events, the source continued, are not on the same scale as the Downing Street parties or the Defence Forces barbecue. So immediately you already have to say, we're not British, but like, we're not alone are we not British, but also, oh no, we're not the army. They're worse.
My favourite part when I was thinking about it was that if the party was in a contact tracing centre and they all got COVID, it would have been pretty handy to contact
where it's someone's birthday, was that classed as a party? Is it a birthday party or merely a birthday workplace gathering?
Well, you know,
Stephen and I love more than a birthday workplace
Dan
gathering.
Has been in touch 53106 to cut me real deep by saying that the HSE has the same level of understanding of investment as the board of Manchester United, which cuts me deep but is sadly correct. Someone else says, we need the likes of Jack and Aoife in the media to stop allowing politicians and senior civil servants getting away with throwing money into black holes where lack of reform is clearly the problem. That's from Pat.
Thanks, Pat. That's really my dad, and he's just calling himself Pat.
Oh, fair enough. Brief comment, because we do have to move on. There's plenty to get through this hour. Any reflections on that poll in the Sunday Times? Micheál Martin now as popular as Mary Lou McDonald's?
Margin of error stuff largely, but as you say, the trend is holding. And I think it's a good one for Micheál Martin in that, like, you know, the absence of a negative is actually a positive for him. given where he was like a year ago, you know, where he had those like that kind of well armed leaking from the parliamentary party meeting, he looked like a kind of busted flush. I think his position is strengthening. He's not getting a post-COVID bump, but he's not collapsing either.
Yeah, it's not exactly a bounce, but I do think people are warming to him a bit more. I think during COVID, you know, he was always kind of the bearer of bad news. Like, we're going back into lockdowns after all the vaccines. They didn't get a bounce out of the vaccine either. So I think maybe this is, you know, the public trying to cut him a bit of slack and being like, they still don't like him as much as they like Mary Lou, but
well,
he's getting there.
If he's as popular as Mary Lou, at least by this one poll, then why is there such a consistent 10-point difference between his party and Mary Lou's party?
You could also ask why Fine Gael tend to kind of underperform Varadkar's polling across most polls, you know. I'm not sure that the alignment between leaders and parties is super strong. And I think at election time, I kind of have this view that Irish people don't tend to vote for leaders as much.
There's plenty of people.
People try to pretend it's a presidential system and it's not so much.
I don't buy it. It's not nothing, but like, I think what motivates Irish voters is not this kind of presidential
style
politics. It's delivery.
There's plenty of people who like Mary Lou McDonald who would never, ever vote for Sinn Féin, and there are plenty of people who vote for Labour who would never vote for Alan Kelly.
Noel has been in touch to 53106. The savings made by having an efficient healthcare system would enable a proper functioning healthcare system. The waste is enormous. I suppose that the HSE does want a little bit more money. We have one possible solution for them.
Your chance to win big. News Talk's Cash Machine.
I make no apologies for how heavy-handed that segue was. You all heard about the big winner on Friday, right? Because that's when Nicole Shannon from Cabaret in Dublin was a big winner on News Talk's Cash Machine. She went into the weekend 21 grand richer, which would probably go some way towards hiring some healthcare staff, probably somewhere. We've reloaded the machine for the weekend. There is a new amount up for grabs, €9,645.32. €9,645.32. To be in with a chance of winning that jackpot, simply just remember how much it is and then text PLAY to 57599. Get your entry in by 3 o'clock tomorrow, and then across the Go Loud network of stations, we will make a call to try and get another winner. If it's your phone that rings, answer it within 5 rings, tell us the exact amount in euro and cent, and you win all that money. €9,645.32. So just text PLAY to 57599, over 18s only. The text costs €2.50 plus your standard message rate. You're playing across the Go-Ahead network of stations. Terms and conditions are on newstalk.com. Still joined in studio to go through the Sunday papers by Aoife Moore of the Irish Examiner and by Jack Horgan-Jones of the Irish Times. I think it's probably fair to say that the bulk of the papers today is about fallout and analysis on the government's moves this week on cost of living. There's quite a bit written in today's papers about it. It's a lot of the Business Post. There's a fair amount in the Sunday Independent on both the news pages and also then across all of the opinion pages. Jack, I'll start with yourself with a very open-ended question. Anything that jumped out for you in today's papers?
The front page piece in the Business Post. I mean, there's a lot of good analysis, but like what we'll read.
Sorry, yes, the other front page piece of the Business Post. Sorry, not about the HSE.
That
did jump out at you, but there was another piece, which is that food prices are likely to rise significantly in the months ahead, a leading economist has warned.
Yes.
Michael Wallace, who is a professor of agriculture and food economics at UCD, told the Business Post that inflation was starting to take hold in the food sector and that it could hit 5% later this year.
Yeah, so there's lots of good analysis pieces which kind of get to the core of the problem that the government has faced in the last little while, which is that inflation is an issue that advertises two things. One, how worried they are about it, but also, broadly speaking, their impotence in terms of being able to do anything about it. Mm. You know, like, mm-hmm. I mean, they can throw, obviously, a not inconsequential figure of €500 million at it, and, you know, people will feel that, particularly on the energy side when it comes in April. But, like, they can't do anything to impact really the larger long-term trends, energy prices, all the rest of it that they're facing into. And particularly kind of, again, post-COVID, the composition of what drives inflation kind of has changed. We kind of think of it as like this thing that has fixed inputs and outputs, but it's not. It's much more, you know, fluid than that. So yeah. I think they're facing a really vexed policy problem. And there's lots of good pieces in the papers that get into that. But like what I think will be a real worry for them is this idea that is coming across on that front page piece of the Business Post, that it won't be confined just to energy prices, won't be driven just by energy prices, and it'll come across into the grocery basket as well. And like, even though it's something that they're politically limited in terms of having the capacity to address, that doesn't make it any less of a politically toxic problem.
Yeah, because the governments are still going to have to shoulder all the blame for it, whether it's their fault or not. And I would also say food prices are already rising. Like, I know that they're saying it'll be 5% this year. They're already going up. But I would also say we knew even before the pandemic, there was around 700,000 people in Ireland already living in poverty. So this is not a new problem, but this is going to get seriously worse. The housing crisis is also not abated. And now with inflation, as Jack said, and like we were just talking about this during the week, Pascal Donoghue, the Minister for Finance, said at the time, you know, there's going to be no more intervening by the government. Like, this is all you're getting. What a load of baloney. See?
Well, Michael Martin said the same on Friday, so we'll count the days until the next one.
Yeah, if this gets worse, the government are going to have to step in again. Politically, they can't shoulder it. There's going to have to be more interventions, and there is, I think they're going to have to seriously look at the rates of social welfare. And I know within government, Minister of State Joe O'Brien has already advocated for this. He's saying, you know, people are living in poverty and we need to look at social welfare. Mm. And that was before inflation. So I think that'll be the next thing. I think they'll start looking at the rates of social welfare, and it won't be before time.
I remember sitting in another radio station in another studio in this building a couple of years ago when the then Minister for Social Protection came in and argued the case for index linking all of their payments, and that was Leo Varadkar. Wonder how that worked out. The piece on the front page of the Business Post also reminds me actually that I spoke on Friday to Carl Whelan, the professor of economics out there, and he was predicting that within the next couple of months, because he doesn't think this is going to be a short or medium term thing either, because energy prices are now built into everyone else's costs as well, that there could be a rate increase from the ECB coming up very soon, which would also mean that households on tracker mortgages will be paying their first increased payments for a little over a decade, which at the present time would be pretty bad news too.
Yeah, and Leo Varadkar kind of found himself in the crosshairs last week for even kind of teasing this idea out by raising the prospect of monetary policy changes without actually explicitly saying inflation.
Say
he was then charged with saying
he meant probably QE.
Yeah, but I mean the whole prospect of monetary policy interventions, like it's something that is happening already in the States. You know, they're flagging interest rate increases. I think like something like 6 or 7 is predicted now this year by Goldman Sachs, which is really quite significant. Now the composition of US inflation is a little different to European inflation, but nonetheless they are starting to sound a little bit more hawkish, and we've gotten so used to, like, from like, you know, 2008 9, 10
onwards. Don't talk about the war.
Low interest, yeah, but low interest rates have become the water that we swim in, you know? Yeah. So people are just so used to it. I think people, like this whole generation of mortgage holders out there who have never encountered anything other than low interest rates.
Mario Draghi was running the ECB for like 7 years or something and never once had to raise interest rates.
Yeah.
Like, the last time they were raised was by Trichet.
Yeah,
like,
it is.
It strikes fear into everyone in Ireland.
What is interesting as well, though, is Philip Lane, the former governor of the Central Bank.
God, you're throwing a lot of names that I do not know.
They're all men. So Philip Lane is the former governor of the Central Bank, who is now the chief economist at the European Central Bank.
Yeah, these are like the Tony Holdens of the last crisis, you know, the Mandarins who became famous. But yeah, Philip Lane, he's as Gav says, he's now over at the ECB, and he seems to be kind of firmly of the view that this is transitory, and you know, it is going to cycle out by the middle of this year, June, July, August, and that is the received wisdom in government as well. You know, that they hope it will abate by then. But I think even at that point, like, I don't think it'll collapse. It won't be like the old COVID curve when lockdowns kick in. It's not going to go off a cliff. Yeah. So, like, you know, we're going to be living in this environment for quite some time.
The Taoiseach and the Minister for Finance both said that they thought this might only last a year. But also, just we were talking about the interest rates and the monetary policy. Christine Lagarde was out on Friday saying that she doesn't think raising interest rates is the way to go. It could actually make inflation worse, put people into more debt, it would endanger jobs. So she's the president of the ECB now, and she's saying that she doesn't think it's a runner.
Yeah.
But I know within German politics and stuff, there's a lot of talk about this now, and they're kind of pushing for it. So it'll be interesting to see.
Germany kind of has this natural national hangover about interest rates because of stuff that went on back in the 1920s and 1930s, and it's actually kind of handcuffed the rest of us for
that's really
options.
Going back in time now. Whatever.
Yeah, sorry about the nerdy bits about saying Trichet, but then you go back to the Wirtschaftswunder of the 1930s and things get off the rails very quickly.
You used to have geeked out a lot in the last 5 months.
Two texts at 53106. The first person pointing out that 5% food inflation is probably only an average because the price of staples has gone up much more than 5% already, they say. And the second texter puts some more truth to that because they say that they work for a large food multinational manufacturer. They've put up their prices by 20% for 2022. So food prices are actually going up. On that point, at the press conference on Thursday evening, when the government published its full plans to address all of this and confirmed the energy rebate rising to €200, including VAT, I put it to the two finance ministers who were there, Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath, that there's always the prospect of inflation continuing to rise. So whatever about trying to help people get through the months of March and April by giving them a credit on their electricity bills, what would happen if the world continued to get a little bit more expensive afterwards? And this is what Michael McGrath said back to me.
You know, we can't predict the future, and you could be right, but the central scenario, or the main body of advice that we are getting, is that inflation will moderate, that it will ease over the period ahead. It will almost certainly be higher than predicted on budget day, which was around 2.25%. It's now more than double that, but the expectation is that it will fall back over the period ahead, though of course that is not certain, and there are risks in relation to all of that as well. And I think you have to look at what we're doing in the round.
So we have to look at what we're doing in the round, which is probably why the government keeps talking about a package of 1.5 billion, even though 4/5 of that was announced before this week. Someone points out that this is all going to ultimately make, even if inflation were to level off, that prices will be high. And unless you have deflation, prices are going to stay high, which begs the question then to both of you as to how you manage to help people live with an altogether higher cost of living baked in from here to kingdom come.
I would say that we need to have a serious look at wages, we need to have a serious look at low pay, and we need to look at the base rates for social welfare.
Which is then only putting more money into the system, Jack, thereby fueling the risk of further inflation.
Yeah, and this is something that they've kind of flagged during the week, that, and it's something Micheál Martin has been saying for weeks, you know, we just want to chase the inflationary spiral. Like, one thing that the coalition has to get better at is, if this is here to stay, like, they didn't approach this in a particularly inspiring manner. Like, there was huge amounts of stuff leaked over the week.
It was proper
old style budget stuff. Yeah. You know, I actually wrote them all down at one stage, and there was like 17 or 18 different measures. And then they're desperately trying to put this back in the box almost as soon as it was being leaked and briefed to kind of try and control expectations. So like, Is there any worse way, any more underwhelming way to spend $500 million than like tantalizing people with all these different interventions that could make these really substantial differences? They'd be like, but none of that and no tax cuts.
I would say that it's always a good sign when the morning of an announcement, the minister goes on radio and tells you that the announcement's not going to be good enough.
Yeah,
it's always a really good sign.
I did particularly enjoy the irony of Leo Varadkar going in and telling the opposition parties that they probably already have their press releases written, but that was clearly a pre-written line on his part that he gave to both of the opposition parties.
He actually at one point said it to Labour, and I thought he got mixed up and thought he was still talking to Sinn Féin.
Lots of texts coming in on 53106, including one that simply just says, if Russia attacks Ukraine, energy prices will rocket. On that cheery note, we'll be checking in with a correspondent in Kiev about what's going on just after the break. Don't go away. Still joined in studio by Jack Horgan-Jones of the Irish Times and by Aoife Moore of the Irish Examiner. I made a few remarks last week about all of the various war references that still managed to find their way into British political coverage, including the idea that Boris Johnson needed to be removed from number 10 with panzer tanks, which is obviously a very healthy analogy for people to automatically lean to when they need to try and find some sort of illustration. There's a little bit of that again today on the front page of the Sunday Times and also in the Mail on Sunday, in which Britain's Defence Secretary has likened some last-minute Western efforts to try and stop Russian invasion of Ukraine as having a whiff of Munich in the air. This idea of appeasing a foreign power that isn't necessarily on your side and none of it ending too well. Let's pick the brains of someone who knows a little bit more about all of that. We're joined on the line from Kiev by the defence and diplomatic editor of the London Independent, Kim Simgupta. Kim, thanks very much for taking our call this morning. The Russian or the Ukrainian president has spent a lot of the last couple of weeks trying to really talk down the rhetoric and say that nothing is inevitable. There might not be an invasion. How are things in Kiev today?
Well, it's a stunning day in Kiev. Blue sky, sunshine. You've got friends, families out in the streets. And apparently, according to American intelligence, we are told this may all end in 3 days' time with airstrikes. Now, what President Zelensky asked yesterday was that if the Americans have got, it seems fairly certain, information that this is going to happen, they should perhaps share it with him. That was his point. Because what's happening, of course, is the very alarming talk that's coming out of Washington and then obviously followed by London is basically causing, as you can imagine, havoc with the Ukrainian economy. And sure, it's not, of course, just a talk, but you mentioned Ben Wallace early on. Ben Wallace talking about the whiff of Munich in the air. Now, as the British Defense Secretary was saying that, how we are some European powers, I presume he meant you're betraying Ukraine. The British troops are here to train the Ukrainian forces to defend themselves against the possible Russian invasion are being pulled out. And so are all the UK staff in the OSCE in the East as well. So there you are.
So would that mean then that if there were to be an incursion, and obviously that's something that Ukraine still doesn't appear to have any intelligence to suggest is likely, that there wouldn't necessarily be a huge support network on the ground to help Ukraine defend itself?
Well, I mean, NATO has already said they will not have boots on the ground to defend Ukraine. There will be no foreign trainers here on the ground, certainly no British or American. They are pulling out as we speak. But also, rather strangely, the Americans and the British have pulled out their staff from the OSCE, whose sole job is to monitor the border, to monitor incursions, invasions, how you want to put it. Now they have been pulled out, which again, you know, if you are trying to deter the Russians, it does seem rather a strange way to go about it.
It must be quite surreal then being on the ground in Kiev and having the government say, we don't think an intervention is probable or likely or to be predicted. Obviously, we hope it doesn't happen, but that everyone is talking about us without us. And then to continue to have this situation where now you have the US and the UK openly saying, we think an intervention is only a couple of days away. And for still the authorities on the ground to be at least portraying that they're none the wiser.
Well, I've been here for 4 or 5 weeks now, apart from you know, some days I took off last week. And the problem is that for the last month, the US and the UK have been talking about an imminent invasion. Now, the incursion may still happen, probably will happen. But, you know, but by talking it up at that level for such a long time, you know, people have begun to wonder, you know, if that's actually true. Now, the Ukrainian government is saying, again, this may happen, but they certainly are not saying it with the vehemence that we are hearing from Washington and London.
If the pretext or the conceit of Russia having so many boots on the ground so close to Ukraine was the prospect of there being NATO forces parked at Russia's own border, and then if NATO says it's not going to put boots on the ground and you have all these other support networks being peeled away, what is Russia's justification for keeping so many people at its border?
Well, there's two things, really. I mean, one is they've got, as you'll know, war games exercises going on with Belarus. That a significant portion of Russian troops are for that. Now, what will be interesting to see is when these exercises end, which is towards the end of the coming week, so a few days after the projected American timeline for military strike into Ukraine. If that doesn't happen, if the war games in Belarus ends and the Russians do not, you know, pull those troops back, then you've got to ask, why are they there? Mm-hmm. And also the fact is, you know, if you look at the positioning of Russian forces, you know, they're in the arc, around Ukraine. Went down to the Donbass and other areas. A couple of weeks ago, there are Russian presence there, of course, but people also, of course, realize that the Russian border from the capital Kiev is 105 miles away, and if the Russians cross through, it would take them, you know, less than a day to get here. But whether they do or not, you know, we'll have to see.
We are all familiar with a lot of foreign incursions all ultimately being down about natural resources and the likes of oil and gas. How much of a factor is that playing in, and this ongoing row about whether there might be interruptions to this Nord Stream 2 pipeline delivering Russian gas to Europe and everything else that follows?
Well, there isn't a direct natural resources asset that the Russians would particularly want in Ukraine. I mean, the coal mines in the Donbass are pretty clapped out. They don't really want to add more clapped out stern coal mines to what they've got already. But the Nord Stream 2, of course, is a huge issue. I mean, it's been going on for a long time. Germany has withstood American pressure to abandon it. Mm. But if there are Russian strikes, Russian invasion, then, you know, Nord Stream 2 will certainly come to an end for the time being. Now, it's a question of whether you know, Mr. Putin is prepared to accept that cost, which seems surprising if he does so.
Yeah, and of course that would then mean even more scarce gas and oil in this part of the world, and then all the other costs that follow with that as well. Kinsam Gupta, absolutely, defense and diplomatic editor of The Independent, joining us live from Kiev this morning. Thank you very much for joining us, Kim. Still joined in studio by Jack Horgan-Jones of the Irish Times and Aoife Moore of the Irish Examiner. Jack, you sort of begin to understand there why that text before the break from Mike from Galway saying, you know, if Russia attacks Ukraine, then we're all going to be hit in the pocket as well. It's actually fascinating how interconnected all these things are.
Absolutely, yeah. And there probably won't be a Biden visit as well.
If we should. Priorities, Jack.
Not to minimise it. But yeah, look, the point is well made. And I think it's illustrated by the fact that, you know, even our gas imports, as I understand it, aren't massively reliant on Russian gas, but there'd be a knock-on effect, you know, there'd be an inflationary effect, there's that word again, on the market. But like, we would be exposed in other ways as well, because there would be European Commission sanctions on Russia. And, you know, both Washington and Brussels have been making rather kind of aggressive noises in that regard, and we would have to look at the exposure that we would have as well. You know, there would be kind of high net worth individuals or companies, like there's a lot of Russian money involved in the IFSC, like the aircraft leasing sector, financial services, and then you look at companies like Okanish Alumina, which is obviously owned by Rusal and has already been the subject of sanctions a couple of years ago. And then there's the non kind of gas side of things, because of the way the energy market has evolved in the last couple of years. Money Point, which is a dirty old coal burning station, has become more important to keeping the lights on, and apparently most of the coal that goes into Money Point is Russian coal. So you know, you do see how, like, you know, we may be geographically remote and politically remote from these conflicts or potential conflicts, but like the ripple effect is not inconsiderable.
TJ Cronin in Limerick, just generally on the cost of living, says, as a farmer I could tell you that food cannot be produced under the new European Green Deal for the prices that it was produced for up to now. We have had very low or negative inflation in food for years. Food cannot be sustainably produced cheaper and cheaper every year. We have been asset stripping the planet. That's TJ's thoughts to 53106. And on that cheery note, let's move to another cheery setting, which is the ongoing impasse in Northern Ireland and the rather bizarre situation. Ethan Moore, who I come to specifically because he used to be a reporter for PA in Belfast, not because of any other, not because you are from the six counties or anything of the sort. The rather bizarre situation, the DUP, who have been the arch libertarians for everything COVID wise, now find themselves in a situation where they may have accidentally locked in all of the COVID rules in perpetuity.
It is honestly the most Northern Irish story that I could think of. So for people who are not aware, the DUP were very against COVID regulations for the most part in the north of Ireland, and then dissolved, walked away from Stormont, and now it appears because there is no executive and there is no first minister, the COVID regulations that are currently in place in Northern Ireland may actually have to stay in place because they need the executive to get rid of them. It is absolutely the most DUP story you can think of. They never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity.
Is there a way that you could fudge your way around that sort of thing? Can you tell prosecutors just sort of not to implement the law in some cases? Yeah. Or could you have London stepping in to pass a law that manages to supersede things? But
that's so pathetic to say, oh, we're just going to tell prosecutors not to implement the law. We shouldn't even be in this situation. If the DUP really cared about the people of Northern Ireland, they would come back to the table, and if it was just to get rid of the regulations, then so be it. The DUP walking away from Stormont, it's my turn to geek out now. The DUP walking away from Stormont is absolutely nothing to do with the protocol and everything to do with the fact that there are elections in May anyway, and what they're doing is they're saying that they're collapsing Stormont because of the protocol. And when the protocol still isn't fixed after the elections in May and Sinn Féin probably become the biggest party, or if not, there is no longer a unionist majority, they can say we're not going back into Stormont because the protocol isn't sorted, but really they're not going back into Stormont because they're not the biggest party anymore.
Okay, whether you accept the pretext or not, and this is an open question to both of you, is there anything that could probably be done about the protocol that would be a good enough solution to bring the DUP back to the table? Because right now it seems, and from some sources in Dublin they have this kind of weary scepticism as well, that nothing will ever be done which is good enough to convince unionists that actually, no, they've got what they wanted and they can come back and play ball now.
Well, opposition to the protocol has kind of become the organising principle for unionism, you know, so like they will always, I suspect within the DUP, they will always problematise no matter what solution is put on the table because it's become the rallying point.
So any protocol at all is too much. That they'd probably needed to be gone altogether, which of course isn't going to happen.
Well, yeah. so long as, you know, the rallying point is opposition to the protocol, opposition to the current situation, I think that they need to organise themselves in that capacity in some way, shape or form.
The DUP are floundering. You know, every poll has them on the back foot. They know that they're losing voters on the right to the TUV and then voters on towards the centre, the Alliance, People for Profit, the Green Party. Young people who would be traditionally unionist voters from unionist communities are not voting for the DUP anymore, and they are panicking. So this is more about the DUP's lack of popularity in communities that they would have been once popular in, and everything to do with that. I think it's so depressing because I genuinely don't think that Stormont is going to come back. I don't see a future. I don't see a way out of this. I can't see the DUP coming back.
We've regularly had Brian Rowan, the former security editor for BBC Northern Ireland, on this programme, and he's written a book about the last shutdown over the Cash for Ash scandal, and he reached the conclusion that time that it took so much manpower and so much good faith to try and get Stormont back running after 3 years that if it was to collapse again, that would be it.
I don't think Simon Coveney has it in him anymore.
Simon Coveney has so much stuff on his plate.
That man has so much on his plate. He has done so much for the North. He has the patience of a saint, and patience is running low. It's running low in Brussels, it's running low in London, and it's running low in Belfast.
There are some interesting columns on that front today. Joe Brawley has a good piece in the back page of the Sindo, Justine McCarthy in the Sunday Times. Owen O'Malley asks what might have been once upon a time an anathema, which is whether the Good Friday Agreement is now past its sell-by date and needs to be reviewed, which is a conversation that we don't have time for right now, because I did want to give the final word to you, Aoife, because I know that in your long-running journalistic career you've done a lot of work about the Stardust fire and about the search for justice and all of that. We're talking to Antoine Keegan after the news at 12. Tomorrow is the 41st anniversary. This is a quest which has gone on for far too long.
The strength and patience and dignity of the Stardust families is something that Ireland and everyone in it should be proud of. These people should never have to have fought the state for this long to find out what happened to their loved ones. The inquest hasn't even held an official hearing yet. It's all pre-trial hearings. They're now, they have a new location. It'll be held in the Coombe Hospital. It's moved from the RDS. These families deserve answers and justice. And I don't think we're ever going to get the full answers of it. It is the anniversary tomorrow of the Stardust, and I just hope that there can be some solace and closure for these people because they really deserve it.
And so say all of us. Anthony Keegan is with us after 12 o'clock. In the meantime, Aoife Moore, political correspondent for the Irish Examiner, and Jack Corgan-Jones, political reporter for the Irish Times. Thank you both very much for joining me in studio.